y'all.
What is it good for?
Absolutely. Let's get said again.
What is it good for? Nothing. So it's really important for us in this upcoming time to be watching very carefully to make sure that the wars that are going on now end and that no new wars are started. This is Chris. The show is called Peace and Justice. That was the classic Edward Steer star song, War, What Is It Good For? My guest did not pick up, so I'm going to put on another song for you now, and then we'll hopefully get on to the show right away. This next is from David Rovick's If I Had a Hammer. Let's see. Hang on. I don't even have the cut on there. Hang on. Okay, so this song was during the Obama time, but it kind of could be any time, I guess. Here you go. Little David Rovick's for you while I try again to get my guest. Hang on.
You can say you are a man of the people, and you have our interests in mind. You can say you stand with the working class, and you would march on our picket lines. You can say you're with the underdogs, not the billionaires on Wall Street. And you look so earnest as you shake the hands of all the good people you meet, but you don't fool me. No, you don't fool me. You can call yourself a man of action. You can say we've got to make haste. You can talk so convincingly about all the hazards we face. You can blather on about green jobs with nukes and natural gas. You can reminisce about your youth and the time that you smoked some grass. But you don't fool me. No, you don't fool me. You can say you are a man of peace. You can talk like you know the score. Yeah, if you were in the Senate at the time, you would have voted against the war. You can say that every drone strikes a blow for liberty. You can claim this is not an empire. You just want everyone to be free. But you don't fool me. No. No, you don't fool me.
So David Rovick's not being fooled, as I hope none of you are either. Hang on here for a second. Okay, so this again, this is Chris, Peace and Justice Program. We're on with you every Friday with rotating hosts. I have on the line with me Danny Schorzen, who is a retired U.S. Army officer, contributing editor at antiwar.com, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, and director of the soon-to-launch Eisenhower Media Network. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, The Nation, HuffPost, The Hill, Salon, Mother Jones, SharePost, and Tom Dispatch, among other publications. He served combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and later taught history at West Point. He's the author of a memoir and critical analysis of the Iraq War called Ghostwriters of Baghdad, Soldiers, Civilians, and the Myth of the Surge, and his new book that came out in September, Patriotic Descent, America in the Age of Endless War. Welcome, Danny Schorzen. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and sorry, there was a little hiccup there with getting hold of you. You know, this morning I had to go back on and just really figure out the timeline of the Iraq War vis-a-vis the 20th anniversary of the World Trade Center bombing that's coming up. It, after a while, it all kind of runs together, and I know for you, you have, as a historian, you are following all of this all the time. And you say here, from the West Africa Sahel to Libya to Somalia to Yemen and Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan, there are more than 100 million survivors of about a million dead loved ones killed in conflicts caused or catalyzed by U.S. wars of choice. Can you give us some more big picture ideas about what has happened, not just since... not just since Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, but more since 9/11, which will be 20 years soon.
Well, sure. It's interesting what you were saying about how it runs together and how it's hard to remember everything about the Iraq War, for example. A hostess at a restaurant nearby said to me the other day, she saw my car pull up, and, you know, it's like a billboard of virtue signaling, I guess. You know, I've got lots of stickers. And she said, oh, I like your Bernie stickers and stuff. And she said, oh, I didn't know how old she was. She said, you know, I'm in political science class, and we were talking about the Iraq War, and I don't really understand why it happened. And I said, well, how old are you? She said, well, I'm 18. And it's striking in a sense that, you know, for young people, this is ancient history. Yet it hasn't ended. So, you know, in general, to answer your question, what is not talked about enough is that, and I choose to be provocative here because I don't think it should even be considered controversial because it's demonstrable and empirical. Since 9/11, not a single thing that the United States military has done, not a single operation has made us safer. Not a single operation has succeeded in any real sense, in any long-term sense. And the outgrowth of all of it is millions dead. Millions dead. Hundreds of thousands of civilians at a minimum. Hundreds of thousands of children. And the world is a worse place, is a more grotesque place. The suffering continues. It has an inertia all unto itself. Another generation after it ends, whenever it ends, if it ever ends, will still feel the after effects. and anti-American sentiment if what you care about is just our own safety, right? If that's the primary motivator, is on the rise and has been on the rise. And most bin Ladenites or, you know, vague Islamists who harbor, you know, desires to attack us, they don't hate our freedoms. That's not what motivates them. It's our policies, and it has always been thus. And so, you know, I think if we need to be more honest about the role the United States has played in the world, because I shouldn't have to caveat this. Of course, there are other bad actors in the world. Of course, there are. I'm not saying that every country is wonderful except us. What I'm saying is that we have a particular responsibility because of our capacity to do harm, because of our power. And with that power comes great responsibility. And I just think we've misused it. And that's the story of my generation. That's what I have to try to explain to my two sons.
Yeah. And, you know, you are all over the place with these wars. You're 1 minute you're in Azerbaijan and Tigray and Nigeria. And it must be really hard for you because you're seeing it in a way. I mean, your photographs show that you, as a combat vet, you have really, really been immersed in what this means. And some of the people that are coming on in the Biden administration are kind of cookbook technocratic, I don't know what you call them, pro-conservative Democrats. And before we talk about them, I'd like to, you know, you'd talk about the Trump derangement syndrome. So first, I'd like to say goodbye to that. I'm grateful that he wanted troop drawdown recently. Not grateful that he just killed, that he allowed his friend Bibi Netanyahu to kill an Iranian scientist to make it harder for Biden to do the nuclear deal with Iran. But first talk about where we are now with Trump, and then let's talk about some of Biden's appointments, because this is where you have just really hit the nail on the head, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to that. I've now done five pieces on Biden's kind of incoming security team, and, you know, you mentioned Trump derangement syndrome. Before Trump got elected, and really, I guess for about the first year he was in office, my hate mail, which has always been somewhat significant, it was almost always from the right. And it was almost always of the "you hate America, you're not a patriot" flavor. I was comfortable with that. I know they hate me, and I'm okay with it. Since about 2018, especially in the last year or two, my hate mail, such as it is, pretty much all comes from the, you know, kind of polite establishment left. And it's of the, well, you're secretly a MAGA guy, or you're complicit in Trump, you know, you're going to end up getting him, you know, reelected, et cetera. And I think that that's frankly ridiculous. If someone looks at the body of my work and even of my, you know, of my light, but sometimes significant activism. You know, I was at the Trump rally in Tulsa for a direct action, was tossed out fairly violently by the police after seizing flagpoles, you know, to try to replace the American flag. So I loathe Trump. I think that his foreign policy has been disastrous in a million ways. He's very rarely backed his rhetoric. There are areas that he's been particularly obscene in terms of arms sales and complicity in the Gulf state grotesqueness with our groupies down there and everything they've done in Yemen and heightening the war with Iran, the assassination of a sovereign nation's, you know, number two or number three most powerful person, the general Qasem Soleimani, killing him, assassinating him, murdering him in another sovereign nation that doesn't even want us there, that Parliament voted us out. I'm talking about he was killed in Baghdad. And of course, just the overt acceptance of this, you know, ethnocracy masquerading as a democracy under Bibi Netanyahu over in Israel, all of their bad behavior, erasure of Palestinians as a people. You know, so Trump's been awful. And I'm afraid of what is going to be cooked up either by him to kind of escalate with Iran, or what will be allowed to be done by Netanyahu, which we saw with this nuclear scientists being killed. So that's kind of where I fall on the Trump policies. I do also want to leave that behind, though. I mean, Biden is going to take office, it appears, you know. And the question then becomes, are we going to train the same kind of anti-imperial, anti-war critique on the Biden squad as we did on the Trump squad? And I hope we don't have another Obama-era dormancy among the establishment liberals, whereby we find out that all the people who were playing anti-war in 2006, 7, and 8, what we found out is they weren't so much anti-war as they were anti-Bush, right? And then when Obama continued much of the same and then escalated in Afghanistan, which is how I ended up in my second fund surge in Kandahar in 2011-12, you know, that there were real costs to the fact that the establishment left was really anti-Bush. And I'm afraid we're going to find out again that the establishment left was really anti-Trump. And in fact, that means that they are in many cases pro-war in the places where Biden actually is more likely to use force than Trump, which is, well, we're through the looking glass, right?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to ask you before we move on about the drawdown of the troops, the thing that Trump has done that a lot of establishment people are saying, no, this isn't the best time, this isn't a good time, look at the rise in Taliban violence. But what are your thoughts on that? Because you were one of the people that were there. You suffered it. You lost people. Tell us what your thoughts are about this, the failure of these wars.
Well, there's no good time if you believe the hype, right? I mean, if you believe the generals, if you believe the civilian chicken hawks in the establishment, Democrat and Republican Party, if you believe them, there's never a right time to leave Afghanistan mm-hmm. or any of the other sort of inertial forever wars. You know, if the argument is that if you leave, there's going to be chaos and that's going to cause blowback and there's going to be a safe haven for terrorism, if you buy that demonstrably incorrect argument, then it's a formula for forever war because it's never going to be the right time. I supported Trump drawing down some, but not all, unfortunately, of the troops in Afghanistan because I don't really care who the messenger is if I accept the message. And I think the message is important enough, at least. So I think it's kind of a litmus test for whether you're really anti-forever war is whether or not you said, okay, like, I may not trust his motives, I may not like his personality, but if Trump's going to be the one to pull down the troops, then I'm for it. I do not believe, and I think this is really undeniable anyone who seriously studies this, I don't believe that America has any real capacity to, you know, measurably alter the outcome in Afghanistan, whether we left yesterday, today, or 10 years from now. Okay? The Taliban is in a stronger position now than it was at any time since our invasion, really since at least 2002 or 3. And that is by every metric that the military uses to measure success or failure. So bad were those metrics trending that 2 years ago, they were all classified. You're no longer allowed to know, for example, how many Afghan security forces are killed in combat with the Taliban. Now, that's peculiar, since we are told time and again since the late Obama years that the number one mission is to stand up the Afghan forces so that we could stand down and all that kind of cliched platitudinal rhetoric. But we're not even allowed to know that. Now, wouldn't you know that the moment that they started classifying all that was when it became clear that the Afghan army couldn't recruit soldiers fast enough to replace their own casualties and their own deserters. So, you know, this idea that we have to stay and now's not the right time and, oh, Trump's rushing this, I mean, that really twists the language, doesn't it? I mean, it stretches the English language past the point of really having any value anymore when you say that it's, quote, a hasty withdrawal after 19 years. This is the longest war in American history and probably the most hopeless. It's a zombie war.
Yeah.
It's already over. We already lost. You know, we just haven't admitted it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there will probably be more Americans who will die there and plenty more Afghans who no one, they didn't get the memo yet that this is, in fact, a zombie war that's already over. So, you know, I think that it's long past time to go. We should have left right after the Taliban was pretty much taken out of power. The idea that we could nation build and, you know, create something in our own image in this landlocked graveyard of empires was just folly and delusion of the highest extent, which really has personified U.S. policies since 9/11.
Yeah. So we need to charge right into these appointees. Michael Morell is for CIA. He is a Bush-era defender of kidnapping and torture. Michelle Flournoy, for Secretary of Defense, is part of the defense contractor establishment. And she likes war. Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State, he is backed war in Libya, Syria, Yemen, everywhere else. Avril Haines says for national intelligence, just really into the global assassination program. But the article I wanted you to talk about, we only have like 4 or 5 minutes, is the one that you just wrote about Jake Sullivan. Can you talk about him, please?
Yeah, so Jake Sullivan hasn't gotten the attention that he deserves. He's my dark horse candidate for the hawk among the hawks of the Biden administration. So he's going to be the new national security advisor. Kind of a perfect storm because, you know, foreign policy power has been centralized in a constitutional imbalance in the executive branch for a long time now. Well, since 9/11 especially, it's not only been centralized in the executive branch, it's been specifically centralized in the White House on the National Security Council. So Jake Sullivan might, in fact, be the most powerful man of the lot, despite being the youngest and despite kind of working behind the scenes. He's a mind melder. He's an insider. He's a sycophant who is very good at getting close to powerful people. His old patron was Hillary Clinton. He's a Clintonite. And so that's who he is on personality, exceedingly ambitious. On policy, he's been a hawk on Syria, Libya, and Yemen. He's unapologetic for how all of that turned out. He was bullish on intervention in almost every case. His language demonstrates that he is not particularly concerned with victims, that there's like something missing. He doesn't appear to care about people. I really got obsessed with this guy and dug into, I mean, I read everything that's been written by or about him available on the internet. I didn't sleep for days. And I had to, though, because he is exceedingly dangerous, because he's going to have such power. And because I don't think that the mainstream media is going to give him the critical look that he deserves, because he looks the part, he speaks effectively, he says the right things when it's necessary. But behind the scenes, I fear that he's going to be worse than the status quo. He's going to be pushing an ever and historically malleable and not intellectually curious Biden in more hawkish directions. And so he is an archetypal Biden bro or Biden sis, in that he went to the Ivy League, he apprenticed for a congressperson, he worked on the National Security Council for Obama, he was a consultant for a British spy chief-led macro advisory partners, and he was a senior fellow at a war industry-funded think tank. And that's what they all are. But I think that what makes Jake different is this combination of personality, philosophy, and policies. So they're all pretty obscene. But keep an eye on Jake Sullivan, because I really do think that this guy is the one to watch.
Yeah. And, you know, as these have been rolling out, I haven't really known how to respond to Biden's picks. Is there any activism that you know about in terms of what we can do?
Well, you know, outside of some of them are going to have to be, you know, approved by the Senate. Mm-hmm. Not Sullivan, by the way, which I think is interesting because he's mm-hmm. National Security Advisor. Right. But, you know, obviously there's some possibility of influencing your senators to, you know, take a hard look at them. There's support for the more progressive wings of the Democratic Party if you're a Democrat. But unfortunately, on foreign policy, our options are circumscribed, at least within the political process, you know, in terms of the ballot, because, you know, we have an imperial presidency that runs foreign policy by decree. So that's dangerous. But, you know, I am not opposed to street activism. I I mean, I really believe that there's something to be said for putting one's body and feet on the line and in the streets and sort of, you know, rejecting this status quo squad that's being fed to us, because we're not given options. We're given ham sandwiches and ham and cheese sandwiches, and that's about it. And there's a whole other menu out there, and there are plenty of other qualified people, and I just think we have to reject this. But, you know, there's local activism and groups, and there's also national stuff, you know, like Veterans for Peace and Women Without War and just supporting these groups. But unfortunately, in the near term, it's going to be really hard to stop these picks because the Senate doesn't have a particularly progressive wing of Democrats in any positions of prominence.
You know, we've been talking to Danny Scherson, and I want to spell your last name because otherwise nobody's ever going to find you. S-J-U-R-S-E-N. And you are everywhere right now, but antiwar.com. You're going to be in an upcoming webinar with Norman Solomon, Medea Benjamin, and John Tarleton on the 12th. Can you forward promote yourself a little better than I can? Just tell us, Skeptical Vet, where should people be finding out more from you?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. So I have a website, skepticalvet.com. Everything I write and every appearance I do ends up there. On Twitter, at Skeptical Vet. And then, of course, if you go to antiwar.com or to the Center for International Policy, you'll find my bio and work there. But my most recent book, Patriotic Dissent, is available, of course, on Amazon and all those places. But go to the Heyday website, check it out there, support mid-range independent publishers in Berkeley, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I hope to get you back, too. So once I read that book, we can have a discussion about it, because I'd like to understand better about what, well, how much we should be tithing the military, you know, how much should we, you know, what should foreign policy really look like? Because it's very frightening right now, and I think we need guidance, especially from veterans. I really appreciate everything you're doing, Danny.
Well, thanks so much, and I'm glad to do it anytime.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, so this is the Peace and Justice Program. My co-host will be up with you in a moment. I want to thank our underwriters at this point. And again, Danny Scherson is S-J-U-R-S-E-N. And if you want to understand some of these Biden appointees, I highly recommend these articles, especially the one on Jake Sullivan that just appeared in antiwar.com. Very important. All right. So thank you to all you KZFR supporters out there. We love you very much, especially those who have participated in Giving Week. That really helps us, since we weren't all that hot on the pledge drive. You can also always tip a show that you love if you're just go on the website and there's a button there to push. I would also like to thank Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And Chico Velo, supporting bicycling education and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when they have it. And for more information, visit ChicoVelo, VELO.org, and you can find them on Facebook. This is FM 90.1, KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. This next segment is going to be underwritten by local seasonal organic offerings of Farm Star Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farm Star features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts. They have vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farm Star Pizza is open 7 days a week for to-go lunch and dinner orders. Find Farm Star Pizza at 2359 The Esplanade, at farmstarpizza.com, and on Facebook. The phone number to order is 343-2056. And by Feather River Recreation and Park District in Oroville, enriching lives through parks and recreation. The district is currently offering licensed preschool care, gymnastics programs, martial arts, and fitness classes. For details, visit frrpd.com or call them at 533-2012. And so let's go ahead and hear from Corey Hemp Hunt, my co-host, with a Sapient Sessions, and he's going to start off here speaking to Ron Topi.
What's good, peoples? It's Corey Hunt here, reporting from occupied Machupta territory. I thank you all for tuning in to another episode of Chico Peace and Social Justice Show here on KZFR. It's my honor to present another segment of Sapient Sessions. In this session, I had the benefit of sitting with Ron Topi. Topi is a veteran for peace member who founded Bike for Peace, sits on the board of directors at the Indian Cultural Organization, and also organizes the local branch of the Run for Selman, an annual Native American prayer event and fundraising concert. As we sat in his backyard, Ron shares his experiences, explains how he became involved in some of the ambitious endeavors he has encountered, and educates us on local salmon history, issues with our waterways, and so much more. I hope you all gain sapience and enjoy. So, who am I speaking with today?
My name is Ron Topi, and I am one of the organizers of the Run for Salmon prayer journey. It is a indigenous women-led prayer journey from the mouth of the Sacramento River. We followed the entire river up to the Shasta Reservoir and then up the McLeod River to traditional spawning places of the wild winter run Chinook salmon.
Awesome. And it's a privilege and an honor to have you here on KZFR, Chico Peace and Social Justice Show, for this Sapient Session. So now I have to ask, is it true that you rode a bicycle across the country?
Three times. Yeah, it was called Bike for Peace. It was back in 2005, 2006, and 2007. We were protesting the war in Iraq. We rode from Seattle to Washington, D.C. We did it three summers in a row.
Whoa, that's intense. What drove you to do such a thing?
After 9/11, I kind of knew something was going on behind the scenes. Something didn't settle right with me on that whole thing, and the rush to go into Iraq didn't seem right as well. And you know, I'm a veteran. I served time in the United States Marine Corps in the 1980s, and it just didn't seem right. Something seemed not right about it, and as a lot of people started to realize, it seemed to be more about oil than it was about any weapons of mass destruction. And by 2005, that seemed pretty obvious, and the anti-war movement was growing louder and louder. And I just had this vision. I'm an avid cyclist, and I gave up a car just a few years before that. Toward the late 90s, I gave up owning an automobile and just used a bicycle as my primary transportation. And I saw it as a way to protest war for oil. And I just had this vision of connecting different peace groups across the country, riding my bicycle to make a connection with all different peace groups across the country. And that's exactly what happened. We were able to network in each place that we wanted to stop along the way each night with different peace groups. And we held peace vigils and potlucks. And, you know, we got, you know, a fair amount of media attention every year. So it was August through September, three summers in a row. We biked all the way across.
That's amazing. I also wanted to ask you about the Indian Cultural Organization.
It's a nonprofit organization that the Winnemem Wintu set up about 23 years ago, I believe it was. And they set it up because they're not a federally recognized tribe.
Okay.
They are recognized by the state of California as a tribal entity, but they are not federally recognized. So they're not part of the Redding Rancheria. Which includes the Nomalaki and the Pitt River Wintu, and then there's the Calusa Casino, Calusa Rancheria, that is also a Wintu tribal affiliation, but they're not part of either of those rancherias. So in order to be able to operate within the realm legally to preserve sacred sites, ceremonial sites, up along the McLeod River, they formed a nonprofit organization so that they would have an entity that they could use to go into the rooms with the Forest Service and actually file suit in the courts and things like that as an entity, mm-hmm. and also raise funds in order to, pay for all of these projects that they have to save all these sacred ceremonial sites.
This is Corey Hunt on KZFR speaking with Veterans for Peace member and Run for Salmon organizer Ron Topi. Speaking of raising funds, when I think of you, I think of the Run for Salmon fundraiser concert you invited me to at Happy Corner a few years back. And so I was wondering what's going on with the Run for Salmon these days.
So, yeah, we've had two of them at Happy Corner, and then we had one at Riparia the year before last. But then this past summer, 2020, we had a Run for Salmon, but we didn't do the big fundraiser concerts before it. And Run for Salmon was more of a closed thing this year as well, so we didn't so much invite the public to come on every day and join for as many days as you could along the journey. And we didn't throw the big concert when we came through Chico. We did stop at Riparia and we slept the night there, but it was just more of a closed group, about 20 of us, the core organizers of the run every year. We just all stayed together this year and went along, and we masked and mm-hmm. and we stayed safe that way, and it was actually a more powerful experience to be more intimate mm-hmm. with just us, because a lot of times throughout the run in the first four years we haven't had that time as a core group, because we only see each other like once a year, a lot of us. We talk a lot and Zoom meet and phone conference and stuff for all the organizing about, for months ahead. But then during the actual run is about the only time we see each other a lot throughout the year. And we don't really get a lot of time to deeply connect with each other because everything's going on around us, and there's so many people and so much logistics to keep that village moving up, along the journey every day. We don't take days of a break. It's just like we're walking for a few days, and then we're bike riding for a few days, and we're paddling for a few days, and we're running for a few days. And it's a long journey. So this year, with it just being us, we were really able to just kind of settle in and really connect with each other. And, Chief Colleen Sisk of the Winnemem-Wintu tribe, she's the, chief spiritual leader of the tribe, had more time with just us too, to help us sink into more of the Wintu ceremonial culture and everything. And she took us to the spring, their ceremonial spring up at Mount Shasta, and that's where we opened the ceremony this year. It was up on the upper part of the watershed, so we traveled from the mountain down this year instead of from the bay up, because mm-hmm. the salmon have to make that journey back.
Sure.
So that's what we committed to for the next 4 years, is journeying from the spring down to the bay now.
For those unfamiliar, what is Salmon Run all about?
Well, it's a prayerful journey to actually call the salmon back, the native salmon, mm-hmm. which are at this point pretty much extinct. I know a lot of us, we hear year after year, it's like, oh, the spring run was strong this year, or the summer run was strong up to Sacramento, and you'll see pictures of guys holding these big salmon that they caught out there. But most of those are hatchery fish. And there's also the strongest run, the hardiest, the strongest fish are the winter run salmon. And those are the ones that have been blocked since they built the Shasta Dam, because they need the colder waters of the upper McLeod River, Sacramento River, and the Pitt River to spawn in. Mm-hmm. And those fish, they can't get around. They didn't build a fish ladder or any kind of swimway when they built Shasta Dam. So since then, those fish have dwindled down to pretty much nothing. So you don't see salmon up in the McLeod River or the Pitt River or the upper Sacramento, up above what is known as a lake, but it's really a reservoir. You don't see salmon up above there anymore. And about 12 or 13 years ago, there was the first rumors of the federal government and the state and the private water purveyors in the state of California wanting to raise Shasta Dam another 18 feet to hold more water back. And the Winnemem Wintu have opposed that, and they held a war dance on top of Shasta Dam to protest that. And they took a video of it, and that video went viral around the world. And there was a lot of people around the world saw it. A lot of indigenous people around the world saw it because it was put out by this project called the Sacred Land Project. And they're out of Berkeley. And the Maori people in New Zealand saw that video. And, you know, Colleen was talking about the salmon and how the raising of the dam would make it even harder to bring the salmon back to the upper waters. And they contacted Colleen and said, "We have your salmon in our river, the Rakaia River over in New Zealand." And come to find out, in the early 1900s, it was one of the ways that they actually destroyed the Wintu culture around the salmon was by establishing a fish hatchery. And they put a fish hatchery right where, you know, where the dam is right where those three rivers back then used to meet. All three, the Sacramento, the McLeod, and the Pitt Rivers all formed the greater Sacramento River that we know that flows through the valley. Mm-hmm. And that's right where they put the dam. But before the dam, there was a fish hatchery there. And it was a fish biologist by the name of Livingston Stone. And he did, you know, years of research of all the salmon up and down the West Coast, all the way up into, I don't know if you went all the way to Alaska, but up along, you know, this region of the West Coast, he found that those winter Chinook salmon had the strongest genetics. So that's why he wanted to establish a fish hatchery there. And, you know, what that did was a lot of the salmon coming up would just get caught and put into the hatchery. And the Winnemem people pretty much had no choice. If they wanted salmon, they pretty much went to work for him. So they all became fish hatchery people to remain salmon people. And what happened that nobody knew about was that hatchery and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife at that time, this was around 1920s, they took salmon eggs from that hatchery and introduced them into several different rivers around the world to see if they could establish salmon fisheries elsewhere. And the only river that those salmon took to was this river in New Zealand, the Rakaia River. So since the 1920s, they've had this thriving, growing salmon run that comes back every year up the Rakaia River. And the Winnemem never knew that. They thought their salmon were gone. So when they found that out, they've been on this mission to bring those genetic salmon back and introduce them back into the river system here. But the dam is one of the big obstacles, and obviously the government is another big obstacle because, you know, wildlife biologists, they've heard everything from, well, we can't reintroduce them because they're no longer, there would be a non-native species at this point because they've been in this river for so long, and, you know, all kinds of things I've heard to say no. So along this journey of trying to bring them back, 5 or 6, I guess it was 5 years ago, a little over 5 years ago, a few of the Winnemem people had a vision of a prayer run, and that's where Run for Salmon came from. Okay. So it's literally a long prayer. It's like almost a 3 week long prayer as we move up the river to lay down the prayers all along the river to call the salmon back. And also to wake the people up along the way, to bring people along and make them aware of what's been happening and what potentially could happen if they raise that dam. Mm-hmm.
This is Corey Hunt on KZFR speaking with Veterans for Peace member and Run for Salmon organizer Ron Topey. Such important information, and I thank you for being a custodian of that, and would like to give you just a few more moments to share any other ideas that are pressing you feel that we may not have touched on yet.
Yeah, I mean, just with, you know, the whole thing around the salmon and Run for Salmon, speaking for myself, I never realized how, you know, we all hear that story of the salmon, you know, when you're a kid, it's like one of the science lessons sort of things that you learn K through 12, you learn about salmon and that cycle of life. And
I never did. I mean, wasn't in school. I was pretty bad at school when I was young.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I didn't mean to cut you off.
Right? No, that's right. Like, yeah. Well, it's interesting that you didn't, because I guess maybe not everybody does, but I remember learning it. Uh-huh. But you know, I grew up on the East Coast, and the salmon were already long gone from the rivers by then. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are no Atlantic salmon left. I think there's a couple of rivers where they've started to restore some runs, but they're all hatchery fish. But salmon are actually swimming back up the rivers again. But, you know, for 100 years, they kill those off early on. But to really understand what salmon mean, and as an indicator species of the health of a waterway, and how important it is, how important water is. Mm. And, you know, since this relationship has grown with the Winnemem, And with Run for Salmon, I've grown a much deeper understanding of how perilous it is, the path we're on with the way we treat water in this North Valley. The water transfers, the wildfires we have, it's all connected. The way that the water is not allowed to flood the valley anymore. The way it's so manipulated, it's really thrown everything out of balance. You can't hold that much water back from the natural hydrological cycle of a region like this that is already prone to drought, and not expect ramifications down the road, imbalances in that hydrological cycle. We've thrown it all out of balance, and they just keep throwing more and more of these hatchery fish in the river that are inferior. They continue to pump more and more water out of the delta. And if they build, you know, now it's down to one tunnel, but even that one tunnel would actually have the capacity to not allow any water from the Sacramento River to enter the ocean. If they pumped at max capacity through that tunnel, it would literally prevent any water from hitting the ocean. And
why is that a problem?
Estuaries are actually the most diverse ecosystems on the planet, and some of the most important ecosystems on the planet. If we want to save salmon, even the hatchery fish need that estuary, because that's where they, when they travel out as juveniles, they spend almost a year around in those estuaries, becoming a saltwater fish, because they're born a freshwater fish. They have to morph into a saltwater fish, so they need that brackish water. They need the estuary. They need the food that's in the estuary, like the delta smelt and other things. And they need the eel beds, the eelgrass beds, to hide in and to cool down. And there's so much there. That ecosystem is extremely important to that cycle. And then they swim out to the ocean, and they head south with the whales and then head back north with the whales too. So they swim with the whales. That's another connection that I had never made before until I heard that story from Colleen. And the whales are in peril as well. And then, you know, when they come back, they have to change back to a freshwater fish before they can make that journey to go spawn. So again, they spend time in the estuary to reacclimate to being freshwater fish, and then they go back up. spawn and die, and then the cycle starts again. Mm-hmm. And those salmon bring all of those nutrients from the fresh water of the ocean, of the rivers, and that DNA, everything, that whole connection out to the ocean, and then they bring all that sea DNA and all the salt, all those nutrients from the ocean up into the river, and then when they die, when there's thousands and thousands of them up there and they die, all of those nutrients come down and it feeds everything from the top predators, the bear, all the way down to the smallest microorganisms in the bottom of those rivers. Mm-hmm. So they, without, and they're water purifiers. They're water nutrient givers or water purifiers. There's so much there that I think we really need to understand that, and I think once we do, we might be able to get some movement and really bringing them back and restoring balance to this valley.
This is Corey Hunt on KZFR speaking with Veterans for Peace member and Run for Salmon organizer Ron Tope.
And with that movement that we're seeking, and you all have been doing the work in creating, what can we do now? What can the average citizen do to impact this as far as, you know, with the Shasta Dam, for instance, and things of that nature?
Well, that's a big start, is to stop the Shasta Dam raise. And, I mean, there's a lot going on there. According to the state of the courts in the state of California, raising the dam would be illegal. Mm. So they actually stopped it from happening about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. with that court order. Because it was a private water purveyor, Westlands Water District, that was going to pay most of the money to have that dam raised. And there's something about, like, that state water project that private money can't get in there, in that way anyway. So it's actually illegal to raise the dam. But because the federal government is also part of the California Water Project, They can kind of go past, well, they're trying to go past around the state, mm-hmm. and get it done. And this has all happened under the Trump administration. They just started pushing for it. And leaving Westlands Water District out of it, the federal government's going to do it. Mm-hmm. So there have been permits, and there have been core tests that have been done. And if you do... Some research on it, you'll find some articles about how actually Shasta Dam is built on a fault, and they actually have kept some of the seismic testing that they did out of their environmental impact statement, sure. because it shows that it's not a smart thing to add that much more concrete on top of that thing. So they disregarded some of those seismic tests that were done. Mm. At least that's what I've read. So yeah. There was the public comment period just ended about a month ago, but with the new administration coming into the White House, mm-hmm. I would urge people to get in touch with their congressmen and sure. senators, write them, and urge them to push the Biden-Harris administration to stop the federal program to raise the dam, because if the feds stop, then it's done. Because the state of California is not really going to allow it to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, there could be a big court battle if the federal government actually started construction. California might be able to stop them, but states' rights versus government, you know, federal government power is that might end up being the battle over it. If we can't get the Biden administration to just say, okay, we're not going to do it.
Well, thank you so much, Ron, for your time. As I do always on this, I'd like to ask you to give the people three questions that you ask yourself, or you would have them ask themselves around moving forward, being efficient, and one proverb.
Yeah, one of the big ones I ask myself every day is, do I need to drive today, or can I just get on my bike? And I've been asking myself that one for many years now. And how are my food choices impacting, you know, other people's lives and other sentient beings in the environment? And water, you know? How much water am I using? You know, do I really need to use as much water as I do every day?
Hello. You got a Ron proverb to send us out of this piece, sir?
Ron proverb. One of the most important things that a mentor taught me many years ago, and it served me very well, is to just be able to shut up and listen.
Mm. Yeah, let people sit on that one for a second, man. Thank you so much, Ron. And, you know, I appreciate all you've done over the years, you know, all your protesting and your organizing. And you've been an inspiration to our community, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Corey. And I'm appreciating more and more your segment on Peace, Social Peace and Justice Hour now.
Many thanks again to Ron Topi for sharing that information with us. To stay up to date with Run for Salmon, check out runforsalmon.org. That's R-U-N, number 4, S-A-L-M-O-N.org, or Run for Salmon on Facebook. That concludes this Sapient Session. Stay tuned for more of KZFR's Chico Peace and Social Justice Show.
And you're listening to KZFR Community Radio. We want to thank our underwriter, Quicksilver Courier Service, which has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. Also, Sonia Airy, an Allstate insurance agent. Sonia is concerned about the community and helps families understand their immediate and long-term needs and goals. For more information about protecting your life, home, vehicle, or boat, or to roll over your 401k account, call Sonia at 345-2351.
This is another segment of Sapient Sessions. In this session, I had the advantage of sitting with Marion Hambly. Hambly is a core member at the Northern Valley Harm Reduction Coalition, Hello? A staff member at Stonewall Alliance Center of Chico, and a shelter operations lead at Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter. They were kindly enough to sit with me and humbly share their personal experiences and curated insights. We spoke of the obstacles to creating sustainable solutions, the community adjusting its collective perspectives on what it means to live outside, tips to staying healthily engaged in the process of change, and much more. I hope you gain sapience and enjoy. We begin the conversation with Marin explaining the inception of Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter.
Yeah, so Safe Space Winter Shelter historically has been a pop-up emergency winter shelter. So there have been many folks who live on the street that die over winter because it gets so cold, and there's not enough shelter beds. And so Safe Space began, I believe, about 5 or 6 years ago, model, essentially. It's been all volunteer run, partnering with largely local churches. Yeah, the first time it started in actually Chico Peace and Justice Center. Yeah, essentially, it began from the attitude of people are dying, it's cold, is there anywhere empty that we can shove people inside at night and do the best we can? And then it grew from there to happening every winter, and essentially rotates between churches. We'd shelter about 60 to 70 folks every night. They'd come in each night, leave each morning, and start all over the next day. With COVID, things have changed quite a lot. We're not able to do a rotating model. We're not able to shelter as many folks. And so in March, end of March, Safe Space partnered with True North Housing Alliance and Butte County to help run operations for what's called Project Room Key, which houses high risk for medical complications with COVID folks in motels. So we're still running that program. We have about 130 folks in motel rooms. And then we're looking for a more stable location right now in order to try and get some folks off the streets, more folks off the streets.
So the community, I'm noticing from my perspective, there seems to be a disconnect with the understanding of what's going on the ground and what needs to be done. And so is there anything in that regards that maybe you feel with your interaction so intimately with these unhoused peoples and the situations that they're dealing with that you might be at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think nearly everyone can agree that there's a lot of unsheltered folks. There's a lot of people with housing. That's not an individual person's failure. That's a community failure, right? We have failed to provide shelter that works for people, housing that's affordable, that someone who's queer, trans, black, indigenous, a drug user, having mental health problems, feels safe in, right? Not everyone is going to succeed in the same type of, I mean, largely what's here is insanely expensive and unsustainable. And so, and that's not an individual's fault, that's our community's fault. And so I think it's the burden and the onus of the work is on the entire community. I think in working with Safe Space and working with people living outside, I just have really felt lucky to be in community with those folks and to really see them as community. They're just people living outside. There's nothing like bizarre or intangible about that. And a lot of the folks living outside do a lot of their own community building. They have entire networks of care that I feel lucky to even get to be a part of. And I think the more the larger community can rally around that, we're never going to solve the housing crisis by yelling at people, or putting handcuffs or towing cars, or, you know, that doesn't get anyone closer to housing. It just gets them farther.
This is Corey Hunt on KZFR speaking with Marin Hambly from Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter. In regard to getting the community to rally around the situation, what can citizens do?
I mean, part of it is a frame shift. I think In the small bananas world of, you know, giving folks food, approaching people with kindness and openness, and being willing to talk to your neighbors, even neighbors living without roofs. I think so much policing and criminalization happens to unhoused folks just because people are afraid to talk to them or afraid to talk to one another. And so there's a lot of violence that happens just out of fear of the other. And so I think breaking that down inside yourself and being like, oh yeah, this is a person. And instead of calling the police right away or getting angry that someone's sleeping in your driveway, just try a conversation. It's not like these folks have other places to go right now. And a conversation can go a really long way. And then in terms of like larger scale, we need more housing. We need more affordable housing. We need our city council to create more solutions, to help open more shelters, to find buildings for shelters to open, and to change our ordinances. It doesn't, again, fining people, arresting people who are living outside because the community has failed to provide workable options for housing or shelter is just going to put more barriers and more gaps to ever solving this crisis.
Yeah, it's in a financial burden that's just illogical.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah,
it's strange. And so in regards to the Chico Safe Space, you know, that Band-Aid that is doing what we can, you know, to at least mitigate the situation. Are you guys open this winter?
Not yet. Okay. We were counting on a building we had lined up to open. Well, first we were counting to open in June, then July, then August, then November. And then by the time the city came around and committed the funds needed to put the down payment on it, the landlord went with another tenant. Mm-hmm. They had waited 6 months and they stopped waiting. So we are trying to pivot. We're reaching out to smaller buildings. We're reaching out to other property owners to try and find another place to get in as quick as possible. So we hope to be able to open in winter still. Mm-hmm. And then we are still operating a shelter through the motels, but we can't take more folks. So we have about, like I said, 130 there. But that will stay open at least for another month, and every month we apply for a renewal. So there's some uncertainty about how long that will last, but we're hoping they let us keep it through the cold months.
Yeah. Is there anything citizens can do to help that that system stay in place and help that flow?
I mean, I think the biggest thing that folks can do to help is help pressure city council and property owners. I mean, if we think of our own networks of resources, like between you and I, who do we know that knows someone that knows someone? The amazing power of living in a small town is that we're all about 1 to 2 degrees removed from everyone else. Mm-hmm. And so I think get creative. You know, who do you know even in passing, and can we leverage that connection or resource to find a building? I've learned a lot about the power of talking to people, and all of a sudden getting connected and magic happens. That's how Safe Space began, and hopefully the community can get creative.
This is Corey Hunt on KZFR, and I'm speaking with Marin Hambly from the Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter. Hambly is explaining some of the difficulties of being unhoused during disasters.
Yeah, I mean, I think working, especially now, this is kind of the second large crisis that our county has worked through, and I've worked with people living outside, the first being the campfire, and working through this giant public health crisis and public disaster, and now working through COVID public health disaster, is really learning about the kind of domino effect of resources that change. For COVID, for example, with everything shutting down and resources changing, there's had a really huge domino effect that has put the folks who have been living outside the longest and are living the most vulnerable situations even farther from accessing any sort of support. During the campfire, you know, there was kind of the effect of all of a sudden the housing market getting flooded, of all the waiting lists for all these different resources all of a sudden getting much larger. And during COVID, we're seeing, you know, just something as simple as charging a phone is insanely difficult, right? The campus shut down, the power to their outlets for the most part. The Jesus Center is closed to charging. Cafes are closed to charging. Libraries are closed. And without the ability to charge a phone, while all of our services are working virtually, in order to get a driver's license, you need to be able to get on the phone. In order to get a social security card, you need to be on the phone. To get a behavioral health appointment, to get called for a Section 8 voucher, you need a charged phone. And so we're seeing a huge gap happen. And I just, there's this phenomenon of people being able to go home and close the door and just not think beyond that. I think we have a lot more capacity to just act. You know, we get so bogged down in, is this my role? Is this my place? But I mean, our place is to care, and why defend that? Just, you know, if we can come up with a way, how hard would it be to install charging stations on light poles or turn back on the power to those, or open up a yard or any sort of resource? And yeah, it's just, I think the amount of generosity and creativity I see working with people who live outside is inspiring and really sheds a light on how much an individual is capable of creating. You know, you see people build shelters out of nothing, of advocating for someone doing poorly, of figuring out how to navigate, you know, healthcare without any prior positive experiences. I mean, yeah, there's just, I don't know, it's a inspiring community to work with, and also incredibly challenging to see such giant gaps. I mean, I get probably 10 to 20 calls a week from folks who are asking for shelter, asking for a resource, and we just don't have it. And again, I don't understand how a community can say, oh, these folks just don't want help. The problem is that we don't have help that works for them. Try telling that to a shelter with no open beds, to housing with no affordable units. Like, that's not them not wanting help. It's our community failing to create options. Yeah, we're all just one natural disaster or personal disaster away from being unhoused. It's not too far out of anyone's life.
I uncomfortably see how close it can be,
yeah.
You know, where I'm sitting, for sure. So it's definitely confusing when I hear some people who are, I guess, a little bit more comforted by their position and feel that they're so far away from that. And, yeah, it can be frustrating and exhausting. So I wanted to ask you, someone who's doing the work and just staying involved, how do you stay inspired and involved and keep going forward?
Good question.
Because we're all struggling with it, you know. I know I personally, I'm always looking for ways. Because sometimes you just get into it and you get a little bit of hope, something good happens, and that can kind of shift your feelings to where you get a little too much hope, and then you get shifted back to reality of what it's a generational struggle that we're dealing with that's been going on for generations, and that can just wear you out. And so I'm always interested to see how others are staying forward.
Yeah, I'm still learning some of that.
Sure.
I think some of the first answers that came to mind, a couple things I've learned in this work that I constantly try to catch myself in is, A, to never treat a human like a job, right? Like, when I get to my stress point, when I'm juggling too many things, I start noticing I'm like treating people like tasks. Like, okay, I need to get this person to do that. I need that person to do that. And that's where I'm most worn down and there isn't joy in my work. And so I think as quickly and consistently as one can to catch yourself from that. This work will always be draining if you're treating people like tasks or jobs. I think this work has been sustaining for me when I can lean into finding the joy and the connection in those relationships. And I work a lot with someone named Sienna. And I think I've learned a really huge lesson in working with her about, you know, together, sometimes the answer is just sitting down. Sitting down in the parking lot with folks and talking, sitting down in camping chairs on the side of the street and just watching or laughing or finding joy, sitting down when a crisis happens. I think literally just sitting with a moment or folks and slowing down and not trying to be robotic or efficient and bringing our whole selves to the work sometimes just means sitting down. And I think I've lived through a lot of big moments, both in this work and in the relationships I've built in this work, by just sitting and sitting with folks. Yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense.
Makes perfect sense. Perfect sense.
This is Corey Hunt on KZFR speaking with Marin Hambley of Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter.
I've sat with a few individuals now this session, this segment I'm calling Sapient Sessions. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's been kind of a common thread actually through all the interviews, is just that community, that sense of community and what that really means. It kind of boils down to what you were just saying there. It's just sitting down with each other and just listening, you know, and hearing and speaking to be heard and understood. And yes, it's been great sitting with you. I thank you so much for educating our community on Chico Winter Safe Space. And at the outro of every interview, I've been doing this thing where I ask my interviewees to share with our community three questions that they ask themselves or encourage them to ask themselves to stay moving forward and grounded and moving efficiently, or just, you know, something positive. And then a proverb.
That's hard.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question that Sienna actually once posed to me. that I think someone named Melissa had posed to Sienna,
okay,
of rephrasing the question. A lot of folks enter this work asking, what can I do to make change? But reframing that to what is needed for change to happen, that reframing it from that kind of self-centered and in independent approach of like, how can I be unique in this work, or what can I do, is an important entry point. But shifting that to what is needed for change is actually focusing on the problem in the community or the struggle or the thing. And then it's either figuring out, can you rise to that or leverage or organize to get that met? So I think about that a lot. I really like that reframe.
I love it.
Another question I ask myself a lot, because I'm particularly guilty of this and need to ask myself it a lot.
Sure.
Is, am I making myself a martyr? Like, am I, cause I think I fall into that trap sometimes and I don't like it.
Elaborate. Make yourself a martyr also.
Like, am I guess the rephrase of that question would be, am I finding joy? Because I think sometimes I can get bogged down in this kind of never ending push of like, I just have to do it. I have to show up no matter what. I'm going to do 10 things a day. I'm going to kind of martyr myself, or quote unquote, like sacrifice. And it is a position of privilege and power and kind of separation from the community work that I want to be doing. That if the goal of this work is to create more community resiliency and community joy, if I'm separating myself for that and saying like, I've got to beat myself down and be, you know, upset or sad or angry or depressed all the time or whatever it is, like, if I can't include myself in that goal, I'm not doing the work right. And I think, you know, not letting myself stop for breaks or joy or thinking that I have to be struggling the whole time in order to be doing the work right, that rest and moments of joy aren't, to try and continue encouraging that. And so asking, like, you know, am I trying to be a savior? Am I trying to be a martyr? And if I notice myself falling into that, you know, stopping and making sure that I'm continuing to also invest in rest and moments of joy, because that's the only way the work will be sustainable and genuine.
This is KZFR, Chico Peace and Social Justice Show, and you're listening to Marin Hambly, the shelter operations lead at Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter.
A question, for a lot of different reasons, I ask a lot, both to myself and to others, is, what do you need? And I ask that a lot, one, because of my line of work is often, you know, whether it's through the Syringe Access Program and asking folks what they need to be healthy and take care of themselves, or through Stonewall, asking folks what they need, through Safe Space, asking folks what they need. It's also an approach I take when crisis happens, and when, specifically in a shelter, when there's a rule that we have that isn't working for someone, right? We are shelter first, housing first model. And there's a lot of moments when we have a rule made, right? We, in Safe Space, we try and promote as much dignity as possible, but there are certain rules that we need to try and keep our staff and other guests safe. And when a rule is being broken, approaching that as, there is some reason why this rule that I've made is keeping someone from meeting their needs. And so instead of putting all of the wrongdoing on that person for breaking a rule, first asking, why is that rule there? Is it necessary? What need is it keeping them from meeting? And can I approach that person and figure out how we can help them meet that need while still keeping the program safe and going? And that leads to very different answers, and then it just leads to more solutions instead of being punitive or chastising. Really just taking a moment to think about, what do you need? Like, what need are you trying to meet that we're creating barriers to you for meeting? And can we come to a different kind of solution here? And so I think just partially because of who I am, I ask that question a lot. And then specifically in those situations, trying to ask, you know, when something isn't going as you predict or going the way you wanted, or yeah, it's just going differently with another human that you're loving, relating, working with, trying to think and ask, like, what is it that you need? And approaching it from that kind of needs-based approach instead of immediately problematizing or assuming that I'm already know the answer to that.
After deep deliberation, this was Morin's proverb.
It's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. That, like, as we fell into what felt like the end of the world, remembering, like, all the things that are happening now that, A, felt impossible to imagine before, and knowing that, right, like, capitalism was created and it can fall. And it is easier to imagine the world ending than it is to imagine the changing of systems. And I think there's a lot of other people imagining right now and building. And that sort of collective imagination, I think, keeps me going a lot.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time,
Maureen. Yeah, I gotta look up who actually said that quote. Frederick Jameson.
Well, thank you, Maureen, for your time.
Thank you.
That concludes this week's Sapien Session. Thank you all for tuning in. And to find out more about Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter, go to safespacechico.org. And as always, if you want to go fast,
what's good, people?
Go alone. It's
if
Corey Hunt
far,
here reporting from Occupied Machupta Territory.
This is MC Corey Hunt.
Thank you all for tuning in to another episode of Chico.
All right. So it's Chris. It's the end of the Peace and Justice program. Please stay tuned for Playing Dead with Ray Lager. He'll be up with you at 1 o'clock. I would like to thank my co-host, Corey Hampon, for this wonderful segments, and he will be back with you on January 1st on the first Fridays of each month, and it will be Desmond Phillips' birthday. So even though it's a holiday, he's going to be here in order to celebrate Desmond. And if you'd like to give money for KZFR or Safe Space or Chat or any other needing nonprofit, you can go during this week of giving to the North Valley Community Foundation. Just Google that. I'd like to let you know that there will be a peace vigil this Saturday and every Saturday at the corner of 3rd and Main in downtown Chico from 12:30 to 1:30. Bring your own sign or use one of ours. We would love to have you. Also, the 10th of December is UN Human Rights Day. We will be at Beal Air Force Base from 3 to 5 p.m., If you'd like more information on that, you can go to the Occupy Beal Air Force Base Facebook page for more information. This is Chris. It's been my honor and privilege to be with you today. Next week, I will be with you again. My first guest will be Iriah Robles. She'll be talking about gender, culture, and inclusivity activism. And then I'm going to spend an hour with author Paul Lauder. He has written a book called Our 60s, An Activist History, which is a really interesting book. And I have a little extra time, so I'm going to give you one more song here. And then we'll go into the community calendars. Please stay safe, wear your mask, and just be healthy if you can. Here we go.
Government had a secret operation, massacring villages, killing millions, secretly bombing an entire nation. They wiretapped a hotel room. They got caught and the government was deposed because of secret documents Daniel Ellsberg exposed. One government came down, and to prevent a repetition of this fact, the next government passed the Freedom of Information Act. Each administration since then hoped it would go away, and then they finally seized the chance on a September day. They passed the Patriot Act before a single congressman had read it, but don't ask the executive how they interpret it, because that itself is secret, never to be revealed, just like their secret prisons and all the torture sessions they concealed. Then they formed the prison program so they wouldn't even have to ask compliant corporations to assist them in the task of collecting information. Every email you ever wrote, every book you ever read, every call you ever made, everything you ever said. I looked into a prism. What did I see? A police state looking back at me. The secret government men lied to congressional committees. Secret information even a senator can't see. Secret bureaucrats working with secret corporations, enforcing secret laws, forming secret juries to serve a secret cause. I looked into a prism. What did I see? A police state looking back at me. One brave man came forward and then he fled town. And now the secret government men mean to hunt him down. Feinstein says he's a traitor. McConnell said so too. But I'd say if we have a future, it's because of the whistle that he blew. I looked into a prism. What did I see? A police state looking back at me. I looked into a prism. What did I see? A police state looking back at me.
To go into the rooms with the Forest Service and actually file suit.
Hey, KZFR listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar. I'm Matt Fidlin. Henlow Medical Center invites the community to tune into its Facebook page or YouTube channel on Giving Tuesday, December 1st at 6 p.m. for a virtual tree lighting ceremony to celebrate the season. The merry event will feature carolers, festive music, lighting, and Enlow's holiday tree, and more. Santa Claus will be on hand to chat virtually with attendees, and kids of all ages are encouraged to post their questions and Christmas wishes into the event's comment field so Saint Nick can respond. The Enlow carolers will perform holiday favorites starting around 6:10 p.m. Then Enlow officials will address the public. Later, Santa Claus will take center stage around 6:30 p.m. for an interview and to chat with attendees. Once the event concludes, a recording will be available on the Medical Center's Facebook page and YouTube channel in the videos section. And in-person, but no-touch Santa Claus situation is still happening at what used to be called the Chico Mall, but I guess is now called the Chico Marketplace. Anyway, Santa Claus will be in the middle of that large indoor collection of stores at 1950 East 20th Street from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day through Christmas Eve, and then he has some work to do. But come for a contact-free photo op with the magical milk and cookie-loving stocking stuffer at the mall near H&M. Face coverings are required, but may be removed for the photo. Supposedly, you can also set up a Zoom meeting with Santa with your child via the mall's website, but I was personally having a hard time getting it to work. But if you want to try, you can visit AmuseMatBookSanta.com, and you can reserve a time with your child and Santa Claus. Now, as the state has seen increases in the spread of COVID-19, along with really the rest of the world, and we wait patiently for the vaccines to be completed and get distributed, there are plenty of virtual events to keep you busy while keeping you safe, including virtual art tours at the Chico Art Center, the Paradise Art Center, the Naked Lounge, Monka, and more. Just Google the names of these places and you'll find plenty to do. Wishing you a happy and safe holiday season, this is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
All right, thank you, Matt. My name's Ray Lager. I'll be your host today on Playing Dead, music